Greetings. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. This is Father Michael. Very special show for you today. Father Bernard Blankenhorn, who is a professor of theology at the Angelicum, which is located in Rome, that wonderful Dominican institution of higher learning, was present here in San Francisco recently and had the occasion to give a lecture on the reasonability of faith, how our faith, even though it goes beyond reason, is not irrational. It's reasonable and has a credibility to it. He looks at the credibility of the scriptures, of the life of Christ, and even the resurrection. He employs the writings and really the thought of the recently beatified John Henry Newman, among others. He does a wonderful canvassing of the intellectual field in that regard. And the lecture lasts about an hour. He takes some very wonderful questions and answers at the end. And it was just wonderful to have Father Bernard, who is a classmate, or at least we were in the studentate together, have him come. He preached over the weekend. And so if you're interested in that preaching a few podcasts ago, that was available, but I wanted to make available for you this wonderful night that he opened up for us as a parish, how we might connect with our Lord Jesus using both our faith, but our reason. We don't have to unplug our mind to be connected to the Lord in spirit. So whether you're on the go or taking it slow, many, many blessings as you enjoy today's show.
So a couple of hours ago, I was getting ready for this talk, and I met your pastor, Father Michael, in his office, and he says to me, "It's great to see you. Are you going to need a multimedia? You going to use PowerPoint?" And I said, listen. I was trained for my doctorate in Freiburg, Switzerland, and there we have a dictum. Sir, madam, will you be using PowerPoint, or do you have something to say? So, now I realize PowerPoint can be very handy for a business presentation, or if you're going to present fine art or something, right? Maybe that'll be very practical, but I think when we do philosophy or theology, then it tends to get in the way. It tends to get in the way. So a handout will do just fine. No PowerPoint this evening. Thank goodness. I haven't used PowerPoint in about 15 years. So I count my blessings, you see. All right. So I'll be speaking between 45 and 55 minutes. And then we'll take a few questions. And then we'll all go home. Hopefully, it'll be a little more dry outside by the time we leave, right? So we'll be talking about faith, and the full title of my talk, which you probably saw, is Reasonable Faith, Belief as Trust in Reliable Testimony. Belief as Trust in Reliable Testimony. So I'm going to focus on this idea of testimony today. We're going to look at it a little bit philosophically, but don't worry, we'll do philosophy for dummies, okay? And then, meaning philosophy for the common man, the common woman. And then we'll also look a little bit at the early history of Christianity and the scriptures. But we'll start with some philosophy. Don't worry, you'll keep up. So while there's a lot of religious diversity in this city, in this part of the country, you surely realize that you're also living in a very secular city, right? A lot of atheists, a lot of agnostics, a lot of spiritual seekers, a lot of people who really don't know or aren't sure about what to make of the ultimate meaning of life. Is there a God? If so, does it matter to me, etc. And we're living in a culture that's very critical of and skeptical about Christianity. Above all, Catholicism and, let's say, evangelical Protestantism, right? And we also live in an age, in a time when there's a deep distrust of institutions and longstanding traditions. So a lot of people think that the way of the future, the way of freedom and autonomy and human flourishing, is to get away from most of the institutions, such as the Catholic Church. And so that's our setting, right? That's our context. That's the setting in which we live. Most of you here were probably raised Catholic. Some of you might be converts. So if you were raised Catholic, you were taught the faith by your parents. You've had it since childhood, since your baptism as an infant. But at once in a while, it's good to ask yourself, why do I believe anyway? Because sooner or later, somebody else will probably ask you that question. It might be good to have a decent answer ready for them. Others converted perhaps from a different Christian community, or perhaps you actually became Christian and Catholic, and your conversions might have taken many different paths. But why do you believe? There was certainly a reason for your conversion. We've seen for at least one or two centuries in Western culture that a lot of different voices in the academy, but elsewhere as well, in the schools, have been critical of Christianity, and in some cases have been looking to deconstruct Christian belief, right? Think of the teachers who would claim very easily that evolution and Christian or Jewish faith are incompatible, right? This would be one of many examples. We also can think of revisionist historians. Maybe you've seen a documentary on PBS about the historical Jesus, and they've interviewed people who say things that sound very strange to you, right? Or that don't fit with what you as a Catholic believe about who Jesus was and where the Gospels came from. And then some of our atheist neighbors, or if we think of the more popular atheist writers, they will look upon faith at times as something childish, right? And that, some atheists will say, a sign of maturity, of psychological maturity, and intellectual maturity is to grow out of this childish faith and to stop believing and to just follow what your reason and your common sense tell you. And then, of course, we're in a postmodern age in which religion can become very individualistic and privatized, right? We have people who are syncretists who are trying to combine different religions and different traditions and so on. Each of these voices will challenge what we might call a classical understanding of faith. So, for example, the faith that Jesus, in fact, lived on earth, worked miracles, died and resurrected, went to heaven, and has an influence on our lives, right? That's a classical understanding if you hold on to those truth claims, a classical notion of faith. What I'm going to do today is a kind of apologetics, if you will, a little bit different from the apologetics that you're used to. I'm going to give you a set of arguments, both philosophical and historical, to show you that it's reasonable, it's rational to believe the gospel claims about Jesus and what the early Christians did. It's reasonable to trust their testimony, okay? My aim here is not to convince the non-believer who might be sitting here or your non-believing friends. My aim is not to convince the non-believer that they must believe in order to be rational. That's not going to be my claim. My claim will be rather, it is rational to believe, even though I cannot prove to you using history or philosophy that Jesus is God and man. I cannot prove that, see? But I can show you that it's not irrational to believe it. Faith, as we know, as we heard in the opening prayer, is a gift we've received. Most of us received it in baptism and have had it ever since, right? It's a gift of God. It's not just a human being choosing to accept the gospel, okay? We can show that it's not childish and it's not unscientific to have Christian faith. As you can see from the handout, I'm going to proceed in five steps. The first two sections of my talk are going to be more philosophical. Once again, philosophy for the common man. And then I'm going to turn a little bit to early Christian history, that is really the first century, okay, the Gospels. So my first section is about belief as trust and testimony. Actually, the second section will have a similar theme, but looking at it from a slightly different angle. So in the last 20 years, two theologians in particular have proposed some pretty new arguments to show that revelation is about testimony or witness, and that faith is trust and testimony, which in fact can be reasonable, okay? Not childish, but an adult, a mature act. Okay? I'm talking about two theologians. One of them is a retired professor from Yale or Princeton, I forget which. And he's a Protestant theologian, and he has a complicated name that you may not have seen before, Nicholas Woltersdorf. Okay, it's a German name, Woltersdorf. Huh? It's a very nice German name. Okay? And then there's a Swedish Catholic theologian named Mats Wahlberg. Mats Wahlberg is still active in teaching. In fact, I think he's only middle-aged. So he writes in English. Don't worry, he doesn't just write in Swedish. So you can buy his book on Amazon and read it. Okay? And Woltersdorf, being American, obviously writes in English. So Wahlberg is especially building on the work of people like Woltersdorf. He's younger. And he's also working with some British philosophers like John McDowell, who I think is also mentioned on your handout. So what do these two theologians, Woltersdorf and Wahlberg, argue? They say, at its core, revelation involves not so much a beautiful interior experience, or not just some kind of extraordinary deed like the miraculous parting of the waters at the Red Sea. Revelation at its core is about God speaking to us, usually through someone like an apostle or a prophet, and us receiving the testimony so that we receive what is in fact God's own discourse or speech. And here you probably realize we're talking about much more than God speaking Hebrew, right? We're talking about God communicating ideas, intelligible propositions, such as God is eternal, God is all-powerful, Jesus is Lord, God will save you if you believe this gospel, etc., right? These are all intelligible propositions that are being communicated to us through apostles and prophets. That's the core of revelation. Faith is accepting that testimony as reliable, as true, as trustworthy, okay? So these apostles and prophets, they are witnessing to us about God, who God is, and what he's doing. Huh? What these two theologians are doing is basically just dusting up, at this stage of the game, they're just dusting off an old idea, right? You realize that they're not coming up with this idea. But they're going to give you new arguments to show you why it makes sense to hold this. Okay? So this idea of revelation, in fact, is already implied all through the scriptures. A good example would be the first letter of St. John. Huh? So John, at the beginning of his first letter, says, "We testify to what we have seen and heard, to what we have touched." It's the Son of God made man. He has seen Jesus, he's listened to Jesus, he's been around Jesus, lived with him, and now he's going to tell you about who Jesus is, what he said, and what he did, especially in the gospel, right? The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. I'm going to argue that this notion of revelation as testimony about what God is saying is not irrational. It's philosophically sound. If any of you came in late, you can sneak up to the front on my left, on your right, and grab a handout. It's one sheet. Okay? All right, let me start. I'm going to focus especially on our Swedish friend, Mats Wahlberg. Okay? Wahlberg says, he notes that there's a common critique of this use of testimony, and it draws inspiration from the famous Scottish philosopher, 18th century philosopher named David Hume. You might have heard of him before. He's on your, I put him on your handout. Hume and his disciples say the following: we can believe somebody's testimony in certain cases, but such belief in another person's testimony should be justified, it should be verified, by turning to some other source of information that can bypass their testimony, such as our own memory of how things have gone in the past, or our own perception of how things are right now, or our own inductive reasoning. I'll tell you what inductive reasoning means in this case. Hume argues that we can trust someone if we have found by our own experience that the type of witness speaking to us about the kinds of things he's discussing has turned out to be true in the past. Okay? That's inductive reasoning. Oh yeah, that kind of person's talked about similar things in the past, and then we learned that in fact it was accurate, and therefore this time I can trust him. Okay? That's inductive reasoning. Hume says we can generally trust some type of testimony because the past claims by similar persons or the same persons turn out to be in conformity with the facts that we or I have observed, or that I recall, or that I can observe right now with my very eyes, with my senses, okay? So what's crucial for Hume is that I can verify what somebody's saying so as to see whether I should trust him or not. He's a skeptic. Hume is a skeptic, as you might know if you've studied a little bit of the history of modern philosophy. The question, therefore, is how do we observe the facts to verify the testimony? Is it something every person should do himself, for himself? This seems a little bit problematic. Why? Because there are many facts that I cannot observe by myself. Let me give you a very simple example. I have never observed the earth moving around the sun. I have never observed it. How do I know it? How do I know that Galileo was right? Because I read about it in textbooks. My science teachers and my science textbooks and the TV told me Galileo was right, and I believed them. Why did I believe them? Because they told me that, in fact, yes, we can see that the earth moves around the sun. They can see. I can't. I can see the scientific expert talking on the TV or speaking to me through his book that he's written for my science class in my high school, right? I have never met any of the people who wrote the textbooks that were used in my primary school and high school and university. I've never met any of them, okay? I cannot attest to you whether or not these are trustworthy individuals. Are they morally upstanding persons? Do they always tell the truth? I don't know. I have no idea. Perhaps the alternative would be to say, well, you can't observe the facts, but other people, they've observed the facts, and therefore they have confirmed the testimony. That's great. So you want me to rely on the testimony of somebody else who's observed the facts for me. That's great. Circular reasoning. To believe one witness, I turn to another witness who says, yeah, I looked it up and he's right. It's verifiable, right? I'm relying on other people's witness. My argument is circular. The argument says, don't trust that guy unless you can verify it. Nor can I say that the overall experience of mankind is that testimony is true, so in most cases you should trust the testimony we've verified it, because that argument itself is based on you trusting other people telling you that in fact mankind has seen this to be true. We're once again in a circular argument. Another path is to justify trust in testimony by an appeal to my own memory. This means that this requires that my memory be generally reliable or accurate. It also means that I should be able to distinguish rather easily between past perceptions that I myself gained or had, and my interpretation of those perceptions, and whatever I observed in the past, which was interpreted for me, maybe in the moment, by somebody else talking to me about it, giving me their witness to what they think is going on or they saw. And it therefore means that I should be able, if I'm going to verify stuff based on my own memory, I need to be able to separate within what I remember between what I observed in the past and what I learned from past witnesses who spoke to me about what they observed. Can I really do this? This last thing that I mentioned, separating in your mind between memories that came from your own perception and somebody else explaining to you what you should be seeing or how you should be understanding what you're seeing, this seems rather difficult, right? Because our memory is consistently a mixture of past direct perceptions and mediated experiences. For example, Things I remember based on what I heard on the street, what I saw on television, what was talked about in the office, and then what I saw with my own naked eye. I remember sitting in the classroom as a boy in Southern California in 1986, watching the television. We watched the Challenger space shuttle launch in Florida. And you remember what happened. It exploded, and the astronauts died. I think that's a reliable memory. And I can verify it by talking to other people and looking at history books. But you know, there's a problem. A lot of my memories that I've gained through the internet, the computer, through the television, they in fact are giving me information which is often a whole mixture of things. Somebody's been filming an event, then I see the journalist talking about the event. He's a witness. Then we have computer-generated programs. Then we have things done in the studio which purport to be what's out there. Think of documentaries that give you historical reenactments of battles that happened in the past, for example, with Napoleon. They look real, right? And then if I think about the news, right? So I think that my memory of the space shuttle exploding, that's very accurate and reliable, and I think that's true. I know that's true. Think of how much you remember based on news reports. Is that a reliable memory of facts being reported to you? Here's the issue. Here's the difficulty, right? Every news report is an interpretation of events by a journalist who's got some agenda. It could be a good agenda. It could be a bad agenda. It could be agenda the journalist himself doesn't quite see because it's from the subconscious that it's coming through. It's just part of his journalistic culture to report in a certain way. The journalist chooses particular witnesses or experts and not others. The journalist edits the interview that he's giving, cutting out certain material and leaving other material in. It's a snapshot. It's a selection of images, a selection of information. Why did the journalist select that information and not other information? I don't know. Is my memory of the news 20 years ago reliable, even if it's accurate? Do I really know the facts? You see, there's a problem with long-term memory. It begins to fade. And we begin to mingle our own imagination and how we think things should have gone or could have gone with how they really went. This is why in the courtroom for criminal charges, we have a statute of limitations, because the witnesses become unreliable the further in the past the event happened. All of this is to say there's a huge problem with Hume's skepticism when he says, be sure to verify the testimony you're receiving by looking at your own perception of the world around you and drawing upon your memory of how things have gone in the past. So that's my first step. It's to be skeptical about the skeptic named David Hume. And you can see where this is going, right? That, in fact, there are many, many things we know through testimony, and accepting most testimonies makes a whole lot of sense, which will then get us to the gospel. Section 2, belief as trust in testimony, overcoming the Cartesian illusory self. We're all semi-Cartesians, by the way. Did you know that? We're all semi-Cartesians. Deep down, some of us still suspect that maybe I really am sort of this mind stuck in a body, but I'm not really one composite being. I'm the mind that has this body that's sort of attached to me, and then there's this world that's out there. When we say the world is out there, we're speaking Cartesian language. See? I was talking to a brother the other day about his spiritual life, and at a certain point I looked at him and said, oh my, you're a Cartesian. Wow. Why am I not surprised? You'll see why. The British philosopher John McDowell has a critique of the Cartesian self, and you'll see what I mean by the Cartesian self. McDowell says, if verification of testimony by means other than testimony, like my own sense perception, my memory, is impossible, then we can treat testimony as generally trustworthy. This claim seems very radical and even dangerous in our age. Why? I can't verify whether Muhammad really talked to an angel and then wrote the Quran. Did that really happen? Did the apostles really see the resurrected Jesus? I can't verify it. These are two conflicting claims, right? Because Muhammad doesn't think that the gospel's true. Muhammad doesn't think that Jesus rose from the dead. Okay. Who's right? Muhammad or the apostles? Right? So the secular critic will sometimes say, you see, you have conflicting religious truth claims. You can't figure out who's right. There's no available criteria to figure it out, and therefore we just can't know. We can't know. It's a mystery, right? Be spiritual, not religious, is what the critic says. How do you distinguish between competing, conflicting testimonies? McDowell sets out a series of criteria to establish when the acceptance of another's testimony is responsible or rational. And to do so, he says, we have to let go of our Cartesian fantasies that are lingering in our subconscious. First, he says, let go of the Cartesian illusion that the mind can attain perfect autonomy or self-control, right? So Descartes was sitting there by the fireplace and in wherever he was, in Flanders or France, right? And he had his bathrobe and his slippers on. He was very comfy and cozy, right, in his warm little house. And he sat there and tried to get rid of everything he had learned from his teachers and tradition from his mind and start at zero. Doubt everything. Start at zero so you can have sure knowledge. What can't I doubt, right? And at the end, he came up with, right? I can't doubt that I have a mind, that I'm thinking. I think, therefore I am, right? Radical doubt and skepticism. This is still all over contemporary Western culture. Even though there are very few, let's call them orthodox Cartesians, right? Meaning somebody who buys the whole package, right? Very few. Lots of little semi-Cartesians running around, and maybe I'm one of them, and maybe you are too. We'll see. Each of us carry, you see, Descartes and his disciples want the mind to figure out exactly how the mind works and to start to get rid of everything that might lead us astray. Here's the problem. We all have a set of problematic assumptions or convictions, they might even be false, that we carry with us. Just like we have bad reasoning in our head or false memories or crucial details and facts about our life that really would help us to figure out who we are or who God is or what my neighbor is up to, but I've forgotten them. I've forgotten. The other problem is this. Our minds are, in fact, not fully transparent to us. Actually, ever since Sigmund Freud, it's been pretty impossible to hold this, you see. Sigmund Freud, you may not like, but he, you know, even the broken clock is right twice a day, okay? So Freud was right on a few things, or he had an inkling of something going on in the subconscious, right? See, someone like St. Thomas Aquinas, whom you might have heard about, would agree that the mind is not open completely and transparent to itself. I can't sit here and do meditations of whatever sort they might be, philosophical or East Asian from Buddhism or yoga or something Christian meditation. I can never get to the point where I can see all of myself by looking within. I am blind to part of who I am. So sometimes your best friend will say something to you and it'll be like a revelation. See? Some side of you never saw before, and your friend has perceived something of this part of you and says it to you and say, oh my goodness, you're right. I do that, and that's why I do it. See? You are not transparent to yourself. Only partly is your mind actually available to you to come to discover who you are. Aquinas says, we know the mind because we can perceive ourselves engaging with the world around us, with other creatures, with other people, with communities, with traditions. And it's in engaging with everything around us and all these people around us that we begin to figure out who we are by sort of stepping back and watching ourselves in action with other things. It's not by stepping away from the world and trying to turn within. That's not going to get you anywhere, actually. Any clear knowledge of ourselves that we have, any clear evaluation of our own experiences, cannot suffice to evaluate what the truth of our own life is, and therefore cannot suffice to evaluate other people's testimony. Because we only know ourselves partly by listening to what other people say to us about ourselves and about the world and about themselves. Huh? I need other people to teach me, even about who I am. If I seek to justify my current beliefs by only appealing to what my mind tells me is reliable, and my memories and my perceptions, I will get almost nowhere. I will end up in radical skepticism. Huh? Radical skepticism. So that's McDowell's first point. Doubt the little Cartesian self that's lingering inside of you. So, then McDowell says, our British philosopher friend, we also need to know the risks in accepting testimony. He's just argued on your behalf that you should often rely on people's testimony. In fact, you already do, you just don't think about it. Most of what you know through testimony. About science, about religion, about nutrition, about work, about family life, etc. It's through testimony, okay? McDowell says, look at the risks involved in accepting various kinds of testimony and evaluate the risks. He calls this exercise doxastic responsibility. Exercise, okay, the next cocktail party you go to, okay? You pick up your little champagne glass. I know you don't go to cocktail parties, right? But just pretend, right? You go to a cocktail party maybe tomorrow. You pick up your champagne glass. You have a little pinky finger in the air, and you're sipping it, right? And you're very chic, right? Right? And you can say to your interlocutor, so, how do you exercise doxastic responsibility anyway? You'll be so chic, right? You'll be cutting edge. You'll be the talk of the town. It's a wonderful philosophical term, okay? Doxa is Greek for belief, okay? How to be responsible in what you believe other people telling you, and how you believe, and when you believe, and when you don't, okay? We need to have a certain level of responsibility in judging when it makes sense to trust someone's witness and when to rightly suspect that they might be lying or deceiving us, or perhaps they just don't know what they're talking about. Okay? We ask questions like, is it likely that this person could have experienced or seen the thing about which they are speaking? Does this person have the necessary background knowledge to give the kind of testimony that they provide? Is this person from a culture that values truth-speaking, or are they from a culture that values saying whatever you have to say to get ahead, or to be politically correct, or to be socially accepted? How much leeway does this person's culture allow for a loose interpretation of experiences as opposed to a strict interpretation, right? We have a friar who says, jokingly, right, never let the facts get in the way of a good story, right? So, you know. McDowell does not claim that we need to find positive evidence that will assure us that we should trust somebody's testimony. Why? He says negative evidence is sufficient, partly because we actually do that all the time already, okay? But I'll give you another reason. The proper exercise of doxastic responsibility, that wonderful term, is a necessary, maybe not always a sufficient condition to determine the reliability of a testimony. In most cases, I will be incapable of coming up with positive evidence that I should trust somebody, and also I might be falling back into the trap of David Hume, who thinks he's got super reliable memories that he can distinguish from what other people told him in the past that he also remembers as maybe even having seen when he didn't see it, or he thinks he can perceive so many things when in fact what he's perceiving, he's also interpreting all along as he's perceiving. McDowell says, basically what you have to do is check for certain factors that might disqualify the witness. And if you don't find factors that seem to disqualify the witness, then it is very reasonable to trust those people most of the time, perhaps even all of the time. Okay? So we come up with a set of criteria. We ask certain basic questions about whether or not this person is in a position to tell the truth and whether they come from a truth-telling culture or cultural setting. Then McDowell makes a perplexing claim that might strike you as just like a trick, like some kind of philosophical trick. He says, we should believe someone's testimony because the witness knows the content of his testimony and that it is in fact the case, what he's talking about. Believe him because he knows that what he's saying is in fact the case. You say, well, no, that's bizarre. That's not an argument. That's a trick. You're trying to trick me, Father. Stop it. You're trying to trick me. We should believe Peter when he says that he saw Jesus alive on Easter Sunday. Why? Because Peter knows that he saw Jesus alive on Easter Sunday. You might say, well, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. Got to verify. Who else saw him? And why should I believe them? See, you're a little disciple of Hume and Descartes. You don't even know it. The testimony itself is the reason for believing, for accepting something as true. Again, it seems bizarre. Wahlberg, who works with the ideas of McDowell, our Swedish theologian friend, compares the knowledge that we receive through testimony to the knowledge we receive from perception and from memory. And what he's saying is this: what you learn through someone's witness, what the knowledge you receive through the witness of another person, is not inferior to the knowledge you gain by your own sense perception or the knowledge you have gained in the past, which is now in your memory. I know that parishioner X is missing today because I can look around the room and realize she's not here. She stayed home during the rain. I know that there was lightning over St. Peter's Basilica the night that Benedict XVI resigned, because you know what? I was on a hill in Rome, in my own house, in my priory, in the big window, looking at St. Peter's, and I saw it. I saw it. It's true. Okay? You know that you were born in a particular city to a particular set of parents. Why? Because your parents told you so. Do you doubt it? Do you ever wonder whether storks delivered you to your parents' home? Right? I always get a kick of talking to like a 4 or 5 year old, and I'll say to him, are you sure you're not adopted? And he'll look at me like, are you crazy? Who are you anyway? Right? This sounds like circular reasoning. Believe that guy because he knows that what he's saying is in fact the case. It really happened that way. He knows it. And so now you know it because he knows it. And he's telling you he knows it. You go, no, I don't know it. He thinks he knows it. You say to me, nope, 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 nope. It's not circular. If you think it's circular, you're stuck in the Cartesian self that has as the default position doubt and skepticism, where I, myself, with my brain, with my mind, have to slowly construct the facts of life and do it with my own powers, my own perception. The Cartesian self doubts another's testimony until he finds sufficient evidence independent of the testimony to confirm what the witness is saying. The anti-Cartesian says other people's testimonies might actually be more reliable than your own memory, because your memory can be faulty, and again, it's a mix of interpretation and past perception. My argument is focusing on two things. First, there's a naive trust in one's own mind that we've picked up because we're all children of Descartes. And next, there's an unjustified skepticism about other people's testimony. And see, we're ingrained with this, right? Doubt what you heard about the history of Christianity. It's an ideology. They're trying to sell you something. Doubt what they tell you about the past in your history of your own country, right? Et cetera, et cetera. Doubt what you learned about the Bible. We'll tell you the real history. if you watch our television program. The Cartesian begins with doubt, but he's doubting the wrong things. He's doubting other people instead of his own ability to come up with the truth. He should doubt the extent of his own autonomy and stop exaggerating the fragility of other people's testimony. The doubt is rooted in the fantasy that the mind is an isolated entity, cut off from the body and the world, able to step back and objectively, without any subjective problematic factors or personal convictions and assumptions, muddying the waters. I can have a clear vision of reality if I just learn to contemplate the way Descartes did, with his bathrobe and his slippers, sitting by the fireside, thinking about thinking. There's a gap, he thinks, between the mind and his body, the mind and the world. And so we say the world is out there. The gap is an invention by Descartes. It doesn't exist. The world is not out there. You're in the world. Your body's in the world, and your soul is in your body. So if you say that you will only accept my testimony that I live in Rome, if you can come and prove it to yourself, you come and visit me over there, right? And see, show me your room, Father. Show me your friends. Let's see if you really live here, right?
I've been in that room.
He's been in that room. You, if you say to me, I only believe you that you believe in Rome, if I can come over there and see you actually living there, and how do you know that I didn't just travel there just for your sake and actually live somewhere else in Ridley, right? You naively trust your own powers. You have an exaggerated trust in your own powers of mental evaluation, and you have too little. You have an irrational doubt about other people's testimony. I mean, isn't your pastor's testimony good enough for you, right? Now, of course, you realize I'm going to try to transpose this into the gospel witness, right? And you say to me, okay, fine, but that's very different from trusting, from me telling my agnostic friend that he should trust St. Peter and St. Paul when they say, Jesus is risen, we saw him, right? Because we can see you, but we can't see Peter, and we don't even know if he existed, and why is he saying this? And you saying you live in Rome, I mean, other people live in Rome, but how many people rose from the dead, right? So you say to me, well, my agnostic friend is not going to buy that package, Father. That's a nice sales pitch, but it's not going to go. Once we recognize the mind's need for the world and human culture and tradition, we can ask far more sensible questions and look for sound criteria to evaluate all sorts of different kinds of testimony. This is what McDowell does when he refers to doxastic responsibility. We are not going to look for criteria which allow us to prove that somebody's testimony is true, because in most cases, we can't. We can't. Not even for the simple daily things. Huh? How do you know that chicken's good for you and it's not going to kill you? Well, the experts told you, and you'll never be able to verify it, I bet you. McDowell is really calling for the proper exercise of prudence. He says, once we have exercised doxastic responsibility, we can trust the testimony of a certain person or group and consider what we learn from them just as valuable as what we learn by our own perception and by our own memory. And our criteria to discern which testimony is trustworthy should also make sense of our established practice of trusting in various kinds of witnesses. Like you trust your parents when they say, you were born in San Francisco. I'm your mother. He's your father. Have you ever proven it? Descartes and Hume do not respect this principle. If we were to live according to their principles, life in community would be utterly impossible because you would be skeptical about everything. How do you know that car is not going to explode when I start it up? Well, because people told us that it's okay. How do you know? How do you know? So we have this critique of testimony. It's usually trotted out very conveniently when somebody's talking about faith or religion. Oh, no, we have to be skeptical. But we believe just about everything we get through the television and through the computer and at school, etc., etc. The English philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe says, testimony is about belief whose object is a person. I believe what my mother says. Why? because she's my mother. Mother doesn't lie to me. Now, maybe in 10 years, I might, perhaps in the 10 years, begin to suspect that mother's memory is fading, and sometimes she's mixing up things in her head, and maybe I'm beginning to suspect that Alzheimer is setting in, or maybe a little bit of dementia, and I will begin to have a little bit of hesitancy in believing what she tells me happened that day. Until that time comes, I am going to believe my mother, as well as my father, in fact. And I am exercising doxastic responsibility. Are there any signs that mom is developing Alzheimer's? No. No. Nobody suspects it. There are no signs. Okay. Okay. Is she in a position to have witnessed what she's talking about? Yes. Yeah, she could have driven over there and seen that. That makes sense. It's not absurd. Divine testimony works in a similar way. It's Jesus talking about who he is and who the Father is. When I first hear the gospel, maybe I don't know that God is speaking in the gospel. I just take it as a human witness about past events that may or may not have happened. I don't have to recognize from the get-go that God is speaking in order to believe some part or maybe many parts of gospel testimony, the stories being told to me by the evangelists. But as I continue to listen to the gospel, I eventually discover that the one speaking through it, through the apostles, Jesus, isn't just a man, but he's God. Well, if he's God, he's the most reliable witness of all, isn't he? Because he knows. This becomes my firmest reason to believe the gospel message. I believe it because God said it. Just like I believe I was born in Germany because I lived there and mom and dad said, yeah, you're our child and you were born in Germany. Okay. Okay. I discovered that God speaks in the gospel through the gospel text itself by believing what I thought at first was just a human witness, an evangelist, some apostles talking to the evangelist, telling us about what Jesus was doing. But then eventually I discovered that in fact, behind that is the testimony of Jesus, who turns out to be God. You might say, well, that's circular reasoning. You're saying, believe the gospel testimony because it's reliable. But in fact, what I'm saying is this. The testimony is reliable because multiple factors show it to be so, but I don't have complete proof. And you'll see why. You'll see why. What I'm going to argue is, we're going to move into the more biblical section now, you see, is this. I don't have to prove that all these things happened in order to believe and still be rational and not childish. And that's exactly how 99% of what we know by testimony works. See, I have never found positive evidence of many, many things I believe happened, but I know they happened because I believed somebody's testimony, such as what I was like as a little boy. There's no video. I'm too old. Say there's no video of what happened. People tell me what I was like, and it makes sense, and I have no reason to doubt them. I have no reason to doubt them. Section 3. Jesus was not a lunatic genius. It's a C.S. Lewis idea, okay? Warburg shows how doxastic responsibility can be exercised with regard to the testimony that Jesus himself gives in the Gospels. He gives witness about who he is, his relation to the Father, his messianic mission, and our destiny. He's a witness. His testimony proposes the truth of things that we cannot know in any other way. Is it responsible to believe Jesus? I can't verify it through my own memory or my own perception. Warburg proposes the following criteria. The criteria would be applied by a first century Jew who encounters Jesus. See? Who is a witness to Jesus? It doesn't have to be a Christian, a first century Jew who encountered Jesus. How would a first century Jew evaluate the testimony of Jesus? How does he exercise doxastic responsibility? First, he notes that Jesus' moral character is flawless. his way of life is in perfect harmony with the Torah. Now, a couple times he seems to be going against the Torah, like on the Sabbath, but in fact, there were certain things that were being debated on the interpretation of the Torah in his age. Okay? Jesus was a law-abiding Jew. From the perspective of a first-century Jew, his moral character is perfect. That's kind of important when you're looking at whether or not somebody is a trustworthy witness. Also, Jesus consistently does what he says, unlike the Pharisees. He is not a hypocrite. Huh? That's important. Next, his teaching is rooted in the accepted scriptures, namely the Old Testament, right? A first century Jew is going to evaluate somebody's claims about who God is based on whether or not it is in harmony with the Old Testament. Next, Jesus' teaching sheds new light on the scripture. He seems to uncover new meaning that is contained in the scripture that no one seems to have seen before. Huh? So, for example, he goes back to the divine intention for marriage and talks about the hardened hearts to which Moses responded by giving a permission to divorce, right? Jesus is going back to the original intention of God that is expressed in Genesis that all sorts of people have been obscuring or overlooking. And so, because he is constantly shedding light on the scriptures and living in harmony with the scriptures and teaching in harmony with the scriptures, we can say he's not a madman. He's too good of an interpreter of the Bible to be crazy. See? I've met lots of very smart, crazy people in my life because I'm a Catholic priest. Eh? And you can tell they're crazy because sooner or later they will say something very bizarre about religion or philosophy or daily life. Okay? It just slips out. It just slips out. And all of a sudden you realize, yes, this person has some issues. This person has issues, right? Next, the Old Testament foretells that there is a Davidic Messiah who will come in the future. So it's not completely absurd for someone to come along and say, guess what? That's me. Guess what? It's me. I'm the Messiah. It's not absurd. He might be wrong, but it's not absurd. Still, the first century Jew might say, ah, he's a lunatic genius. That's why he's such a smart interpreter of scripture. Warburg says the lunatic genius hypothesis becomes highly unlikely, if not impossible, for three reasons. Why? First, you witness Jesus doing miracles. Now, you might doubt whether or not miracles happen, but you know what? The way the apostles behaved after Jesus' death, and we believe his resurrection, but after his death, the way they behaved makes a whole lot of sense if Jesus actually worked miracles. It doesn't really make much sense if he didn't work any miracles. Okay? So just keep that in the back of your mind. You, the first century Jew, seeing Jesus in Jerusalem, you saw him perform what seems to be a miracle. At least it's worth investigating. Lunatic geniuses don't do that. It's confirmed that his tomb was empty 2 days after his death, and there are reports that he's alive. Now, maybe the reports are wrong, but you know what? If he's a lunatic genius, how does he do the empty tomb part? How does he do that? Third, you meet the risen Jesus, or at least you think you do. The lunatic genius hypothesis can't explain that. Why am I having this illusion? Delusion of Jesus being risen, or the actual experience of him being risen, because he really is risen. The lunatic genius hypothesis cannot explain these three pieces of data. They cannot explain why there seem to be miracles, why the tomb is apparently empty, why people are seeing the risen Christ. That's not what lunatic geniuses do. But if Jesus transmitted God's message, and if God is who Jesus says he is, then in fact, all of it fits. The miracles were done. They're real. They were done because God was doing them through Jesus. The tomb is empty because he's risen again. That's why his corpse isn't there. His body's not there. People are seeing him not because they're on drugs, but because they're actually seeing a risen person, a risen human being. are three pieces of data: the claim to work miracles, and apparently many people who are witnessing to them, the empty tomb, the reports of the risen Christ. These are not proof that Jesus' testimony is true. You could explain the empty tomb with the claim that the corpse was stolen, which is the story that the Jews told. Peter's encounter with the risen Jesus may have been a delusion on Peter's part. The skeptic can reasonably claim that. But given the three pieces of data, it's no longer irrational to also believe something else, namely that Jesus is who he says he is, and he really rose from the dead. It becomes doxastically responsible to do so. We haven't proven that Jesus rose from the dead. We've shown that it makes sense to believe that he did. Somewhat as you've never proven that you were born in San Francisco, but it makes a whole lot of sense for you to trust your parents' testimony that you were. And there's no need to go and verify it in this case. Today you trust your memory because you have no significant reason not to do so. And you trust your sense as well, because as far as you know, you haven't taken any drugs, nobody slipped anything in your drink, you're not dreaming, you trust your senses right now. And well, you have no reason, serious reason, to have serious doubts about these testimonies, given what happened and who is speaking. You believe Jesus, and Jesus tells you that God is speaking through him. And you know that God speaks through him because Jesus said so, and it is rational, it's reasonable to believe. The alternative is methodological doubt, which is simply naive, because we don't apply such doubt to hardly any other aspect of human life. I am going to I've gone about 45 minutes, haven't I? I'm going to cut some of this short so we can get to your questions, huh? Let me see. Let me move to the last section, the apostles as reliable witnesses. The Bible gives us all first century Christian texts that we know about. Every other ancient Christian text, or a text that claims to be Christian or pseudo-Christian, comes after the first century. All the Gnostic Gospels, all the pseudo-Gospels, the Gospels of Peter, of Philip, of Mary Magdalene, of Judas, etc., they're all second, sometimes third century. We have other texts like letters of, say, St. Ignatius, or the works of St. Justin Martyr and others, Polycarp. These are all second century, some of them highly reliable, some of them very dubious. All first century Christian literature is in the Bible. It's in the New Testament, and it tells us about what the first witnesses to Jesus say. It gives us their testimony. It's the most ancient and also the most reliable witness to who Jesus was and what he said. Their witness will give us the best access possible to the real Jesus. Why is believing their testimony responsible or reasonable? When they make wild claims about Jesus resurrecting, we can trust them and still be reasonable. Why? Number one, the apostles were simple fishermen. They spent half their lives preaching about a Jew named Jesus to anyone willing to listen, even on the other side of their known world, the Mediterranean, traveling all over the place. This is a very strange lifestyle for a group of uneducated Galilean Jewish fishermen. It's very strange behavior for fishermen. It would be really strange if none of them had ever met the risen Jesus. That tells you that the hypothesis of the stolen corpse is problematic. And if the resurrection of Jesus is real, then so much else of what is happening in the scriptures is also reliable. So that's your first reason to trust the apostles. Number two, the apostles gained no wealth or power by their preaching. Instead, they gained social marginalization within Judaism and martyrdom at the hands of the Romans. Why did the apostles sacrifice so much if their message was a pious invention or false or a lie? Why would they suffer so much for a delusion, for a story they had invented? That's your second reason to trust them. See, the apostles' witness is given to you in the New Testament, even if they didn't write many of the texts that are in there, but their testimonies behind the texts being written. Number three, the apostles were terrorized and dispersed when Jesus was crucified and died. A few days later, they became courageous public witnesses to the resurrection. This change in behavior is very hard to explain if he didn't really rise from the dead. Did they all get together and decide to just come up with a new story and then finally, suddenly find courage when they had zero before? The last reason to trust them, the most powerful religious and political authorities of the age, whether Roman or Jewish, actively opposed or ignored the apostles and their disciples, but the movement still succeeded. Christianity gained about a 10% adherence in the population of the Roman Empire by the late 3rd century, even though it began with a few dozen people and suffered sporadic persecution and constant social marginalization, which often also brought economic marginalization, you realize, poverty. All this happened before Constantine legalized Christianity. 10% of the population became Christian, more or less. We don't need a conspiracy theory to explain how this happened. It makes sense if Christ actually rose from the dead. Why do I believe in the gospel? Because I know what Jesus said and did, thanks to the testimony of the apostles and the first disciples who wrote the books of the New Testament, who founded the church that gave us the preaching of Christ and the early events. By pondering who the apostles were and how the Bible was written, it's reasonable to believe in their message. That doesn't mean that not believing is simply irrational. It means that it does make sense to believe the apostles and therefore to believe Christ, just as it is very reasonable to believe just about everything, not everything, but just about everything that your parents told you and perhaps much of what your teachers in school told you, not to mention the textbooks whose authors you have never met. A disciple of Jesus believes firmly because it's a gift, but the gift doesn't make him childish or irrational. So I'm going to stop there and see if you have some questions on what I've been presenting to you. So notice we have two main sections, right? The more philosophical section and then the more sort of biblical historical question of what happened in the first century. We're squeezing a lot of information into one little hour. Yes, in the back.
So, in your first part, you talked a bit about the Cartesian idea of not being able to... You should prioritize your own limitations of perception and cognition in favor of the testimony of others, right? But if everybody has the same limitations...
If there's a problem with the Cartesian self, you're asking, and if I should have a certain skepticism about my own perceptions and memory and more reliance on other people's testimony, then if everybody's in the same boat, doesn't that create a problem because now everybody's relying on everybody else, right? Here's the thing, right? Part of what I was saying was a little bit for rhetorical effect, right? So I was trying to provoke you to sort of tease you into thinking about what's going on in terms of, you know, maybe we in fact do in our daily life have a little bit too much trust and reliance in our own evaluation and judgment of things and the way we put our perceptions together and try to see what's going on, right? And we have too much skepticism about custom, about tradition, about community, right? Obviously, most of us need to have reliable perceptions and memories most of the time for community even to work, right? What I would say, once I get beyond my rhetorical sort of effect here, is this, right? We should have more or less an equality between the kind of reliance I have in perception, memory, and other people's testimony. We need to combine these and recognize that there's a consistency among them. There's a limit to each one. There are unreliable witnesses, right? There are cultures that tell lies communally, right? But even the smartest professor, let's say of history, will interpret historical data partly based on certain presuppositions and convictions he's bringing to the table, which cannot be rationally proven as the right ones. And he may not even see all of them because he's not transparent to himself, you see. So I need, it's like checks and balances, right? I need all three. It's kind of like if I need the presidency, the Congress, and the courts to work. If one of them really fails, we're in big trouble in this country, right? Same thing with memory, perception, testimony. Right. So I think this is really what McDowell's doing, and then Wahlberg following him, is to say, stop underestimating testimony and putting it down here in third place. Right. That's what he's saying. And reflect on how much you learn because of community, because of tradition, because of your family, right? And if you don't have a basic disposition of trust to these witnesses, then your life, you will become psychotic, basically. You'll become asocial. You'll become incapable of living in community, meaning you're going to be a very screwed up human being, right? So what is faith? What is Christian faith? Christian faith asks us to take a disposition that we normally we have in a healthy human life on a daily basis and simply take it one step further. There are these people telling me about X having happened, which I can never verify. But what they're saying kind of makes sense based on how they're behaving and based on their moral character and who they are, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So it's good. You called me out on a little bit of a rhetorical excess there, right? So, yeah. That's great. I love it. Okay, and over here. Sure. Right? Absolutely.
Fast-growing religions, right?
Yeah.
Mormons,
yeah.
Muslims.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And they also claim miracles happen.
Right.
And faith is exploding. So we just go, like, how do you say, because a lot of these claims are contradictory, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
So, I mean, I believe, I'm Catholic, I believe mm-hmm. our claims, but I don't really know how to answer that question.
Right, that's probably a very common objection to say, well, other people claim to have miracles, to have a special revelation, to have a prophetic revelation. Why is the apostolic claim reliable instead of, say, Muhammad or the Mormons, etc., right? Okay, so let's look at that very, very briefly, very simply. All right. Most of the major religions, other than Judaism and Christianity, do not make claims of extensive, numerous, many miracles and many great miracles happening through, let's say, their founding figure. Okay? Muhammad worked next to no miracle. And it was not, the Muslims do not even claim that he did work many, many miracles. Okay, nor, to my knowledge, do we have consistent claims through the centuries in Islam that let's say, a visit to a holy site like Mecca would produce all sorts of miracles and healings. In Judaism, if you look at the Old Testament story, and in Christianity, in the Bible, but all through the church's life, we have a consistent appeal to miracles happening. I know people who say they've witnessed miracles. I think I've probably witnessed one or two. Okay? So in fact, there are the claim to having many miracles as a verification of revelation is somewhat unique to Christianity and Judaism. Okay? Another thing, Islam is based on the claim of a prophecy made by one man. Right? Christianity is based on the claims of revelation made by a whole series of Old Testament patriarchs and prophets and a whole group of New Testament apostles and other disciples. Muhammad's revelation seems to have fallen from the sky. If it happened, I don't think it did. Okay? It falls from the sky. Judaism and Christianity claim that various things happen in history, and these are tied up with peoples and places that, in fact, we know about through other sources. See? I can go to Bethlehem and Jerusalem and look around and see and look at the descendants of the people who lived there in the biblical era, right? So what's unique about, in many ways, right, if you think of this, what's Buddhism based on? It's based on the claims of what the Buddha experienced in his own contemplation and then preached about, right? The apostles and the Old Testament prophets are making claims about all sorts of historical events that other peoples could verify. So now we can go and see, okay, what do the Egyptian historical records look like? Is there room in the Egyptian history that we know of, that we've been able to recover, where we could see where something like the Exodus could have happened? See? I can make these. We have a Roman emperor, I think it's Trajan, who says, yeah, there was this Jesus and they crucified him. So here's a pagan who doesn't believe, who says, yeah, there was that Jesus and he was actually crucified and he died, which Muhammad denies, right? So some things in the scriptures I can verify through these other historical witnesses, right? So then beyond that, I mean, it also would have to be, I'd have to look at content, right? What's the actual truth claim being made about? What's the meaning of human life, that there's a human soul? Does that make sense? The ethical teachings, do these fit into how we kind of see what a good moral life is like, et cetera, right? You have a whole set of other things to consider. Internal consistency, right? Are there contradictions between the texts, let's say, of this one religion, within the texts of one religion? So I think in this sense, you start to make some progress and say, well, it's actually not the same thing. It's not the same kind of claim as, say, the Muslim is making on behalf of his faith. See? Islam doesn't really talk about faith anyway. See? Whereas faith is something that's very Christian, actually. See? Am I answering your question?
Yes.
Okay. So if you want to read about miracles, there's a local expert named Father Anselm Romolo. And he's written a lot about miracles, and he shows the difference between the Christian claims about miracles as opposed to, let's say, the Muslim or the Jewish Buddhist claims of miracles. You know, yeah, good. So like somebody healing in the name of Jesus becomes a witness to who Jesus is that should provoke something in you, either acceptance or rejection, see? And it's very clear, right? In the Gospels, Jesus works miracles partly to draw people to faith. And St. Paul thinks that some receive a charism of miracles in order to draw yet other people to faith. See? So this is really important, actually. It's very important. Okay. Yes? Since they were
written so long after the fact.
Ah, but were they? Why should we trust the Gospels if they were written so long after the fact?
Just in general,
yeah. Okay. So the Gospels were written, let me take up your first question. The Gospels were written sometime between 60 and 100 AD. Two or three of them, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were probably written sometime between 60 and 70. So they were written within about 40 years or so of Jesus' death. A typical ancient biography or story about historical figures was often written long after, even centuries after. So it's actually not very long thereafter. It's soon enough that the writers of the Gospels could have had direct contact with some of the apostles who might have been aging or moving toward their martyrdom, right? In fact, there's a great book that's on your bibliography by Richard Bauckham. He's a British Anglican New Testament scholar, and he talks about why it makes a lot of sense to see the Gospels as the fruit of eyewitness testimony. See? So, number one, they're written pretty early. Number two, if I understand ancient historiography, meaning the science of the method of history in antiquity, then I realize that the slight discrepancies in the reports, let's say, of what happened when Jesus was crucified or arose, there are slight differences, right, between the different Gospels. If I look at the way ancient histories were written, those discrepancies are kind of typical. They don't really signal to me that there's a big problem and a kind of contradiction between witnesses, see? There's a legitimate sort of layer of interpretation that's allowed in a historical text. So it fits a historical genre without major contradictions about the major events recounted. It's written fairly early. All the first century literature is in there. There's a doctrinal consistency within the Gospels of what they're teaching about what the good life is and how you should live as a Christian. It's doctrinally consistent with the Old Testament. The people talked about in there and the people who are speaking, like St. Paul, are witnessed to by other people coming shortly thereafter in other texts. These are not people who are sort of invented by somebody out of thin air, right? The competing Gospels of the age would be second century, and they have a consistently, let's call it, anti-Old Testament dualist view of reality, meaning they oppose the Old Testament God to the New Testament God, they oppose the God of Jesus to the God of the Jews, and they have a very low view of the human body and material reality, whereas the Gospels don't do this. Okay? So these would be some of the criteria that I could use to say it makes sense that those are reliable, the more reliable witnesses. Let me get to the second part of your question. Remind me again. How long after? Okay.
I guess
to me, being written 60 or 70 years after, that seems like a long time. Sure. So today, we're used to seeing, because of the printing press and because of technology and because of the wealth, right? We're used to seeing people write history about the Obama administration, right? We have books out. Huh? In antiquity, we have a lot fewer books being published because it's expensive, right? We have a lot smaller population. There is no printing press. We have a culture of a very rich oral tradition and memory. Many ancient Jews memorized word for word large chunks of the Bible. If you go to Middle Eastern villages that speak Aramaic or Syriac today, in places like Iraq or Syria or Palestine, Israel, you will probably be able at some point, if you look long enough, to find the remnants of this ancient oral culture that has an extremely rich memory, where they can, basically, you've got a village that's memorized, long stories, narratives, poems, and everything, and word for word. And they can help each other when somebody gets it wrong when they're recounting it. Oh, no, you missed a word. See, we don't get that. Illiteracy is really helpful to have a good oral tradition, okay? If you want good memory, don't learn how to read. So if you have a lot of illiterate people back then, that's actually helpful to preserve the oral tradition, see? So back then, I mean, if you have access to the actual witnesses and or to people who talk to the witnesses in that oral culture, you can get a lot of rich and accurate information, right? Or we could also say this, right? All the archaeological data that we're finding is in harmony with what the gospel claims have been, you know? So for example, the more they dig up the ruins in various parts of Turkey and other parts of the Mediterranean, the more they say, you know what, when the book of Acts says, well, Paul went from here to there, and this is what he did, and this is who was in charge, and this is who he talked to, yeah, the Roman documents we've just found say that so-and-so really was in charge, and that's actually the date that the book of Acts says he was there, and so Luke seems to know what he's talking about, right? It's not a proof that Luke is reliable. It's a reason to think that he probably is reliable. I can't prove to you that he's reliable. That's the gift of faith, see? But I can show you that it kind of makes sense to say that Luke knew what he was doing. So the way the ancients did history is very different. The oldest fragment we have of the Gospel of John is from, I think, the year 125, which would place it within 20 years of its composition and less than 100 years after the life of Jesus. For many, many ancient documents that we have, the oldest manuscript is from a time period that is 500 to even 1,000 years after the original text was written. See? There are a lot of ancient texts about which we only know through medieval manuscripts. And most people in the academy have no problem accepting that that is a book by Aristotle, and that's a book by Plato, and that's a book by Cicero. And for the Gospel of John, we have a clear little fragments that we found that are 125 AD. That's kind of amazing, actually. See, it's pretty amazing. We have other texts that are more 4th century, huh, from the Gospels. So, other things? Yes?
I just thought you mentioned
Josephus. There's so much more to talk about, right? Yeah. Right. Right. So, you know, Josephus, the Jewish historian who wrote a famous book on the Roman wars against the Jewish uprisings, right? I mean, he's interesting to see what first century Palestine looked like, what the fall of the temple was about, etc. But I think we get a pretty good picture of what Judaism was like. But if we want to see more about the events recounted in the New Testament, we get a little more information from other sources. Yeah, that would be a main reason. Yeah. Just like, you know, Qumran, right, is fascinating, but it doesn't tell us about the New Testament. It's Old Testament, you know. So, and yeah. What Qumran tells us, right, these are pre-Christian scrolls found near the Dead Sea in this cave by chance, is that, you know, the text given to us mostly through a second century Jewish tradition, it's called the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text of the Old Testament. There are little discrepancies here and there, huh? There's no revolution in how we understand the beliefs of ancient Jews based on what we found in Qumran. It's a consistent picture, you know. You improve your view of the details, basically, you know. Ancient traditions can be pretty reliable. Can be. Must not be. Can be, right? Okay. Maybe one or two questions. Yes?
Father, you seem pretty confident in terms of the Gospels being written about 128 or the first, second century, but we're not terribly sure that it was by St. John or by Mark and Luke.
Okay.
So,
sure. Yeah. Okay, so your question is more about the particular author of the Gospels more than the date. Okay. So the date we can tell because these texts are then also being used by other authors, for example, in the early and mid-second century. Okay? So they're clearly working off of existing gospel texts or traditions that are very, very close to gospel texts that we can see being used, right? How do we know that Matthew wrote Matthew? Do we have an absolute historical proof? No. By the way, history almost always gives you probabilities. Okay? Almost always gives you probabilities. That's how history works. That's its job, right? So, the ancient view of authorship is a little more elastic than ours. If there's a book published under Father Michael Hurley's name, then you would expect that the words in that book are really coming from him, okay? In the ancient world, you could more easily attribute a book to a person if the content or the message were faithful to who that person was, even though the exact words may not go back to him. This has to actually be the case for the Gospels because, first of all, Jesus typically didn't teach in Greek. Although he actually spoke Greek, there's pretty good evidence for it. Okay? Jesus usually spoke in Aramaic. We don't have an Aramaic New Testament from the first century. We have a Greek New Testament, right? Why do we say that? So when somebody says Gospel of Matthew, what that means in the context is this is coming from the preaching or the writing of Matthew. Mark seems to be coming from the preaching of Peter, and he was his disciple. He worked with him and helped Peter for several years before Peter's martyrdom, right? So is it necessary that John wrote all of John? No. Does John's witness and that of other apostles about Jesus need to be the fount of the message being given? Yes. Why do we attribute it to those people? They're the only ones to whom those texts were ever attributed starting in the second century in the manuscripts. Matthew was never attributed to Luke. John was never attributed to somebody else, never. If there's a name on the text, a name in the tradition, it's that one name for that same gospel. It's very consistent. It's very interesting, huh? Why would that be? Why would that be? There's a Lutheran scholar, deceased named now, his name is Martin Hengel, H-E-N-G-E-L, who talks about this. See? So what's interesting is the Gospels are linked with particular apostles because what they're claiming is a particular line, a tradition, a source, a witness that can verify what is being said, right? But yeah, authorship is a little bit of a different notion than in antiquity, right? So when Deuteronomy says, and Moses wrote this, you know, it's not absolutely necessary that Moses wrote all of Deuteronomy for Deuteronomy to be true. It's the ancients' way of saying, Moses taught something like this. Moses taught this, right? In antiquity, it's an acceptable practice in writing history to put some words into a person's mouth if you're convinced that it's faithful to their message. So John's Jesus sounds a little different from Matthew's Jesus. They use very different words. Why? You know, did Jesus speak Joannine language one day and the next day say, okay, this morning I'll be speaking in Matthean, okay? So just settle down. So John, stop writing. Okay, this is from Matthew. This is from Mark, right? No, right? The evangelist has a hand in the formulation, in the crafting of the text, right? You look at the Gospel of John, it has a very, very neat structure. That's legitimate. Why? Revelation didn't stop with the ascension of Jesus. Public revelation was completed with the death of the last apostle. And the apostles kept receiving revelation through the illumination of the Holy Spirit, who was sent, by the way, by the glorified Christ, to teach the apostle to make sense and to transmit well the message that Jesus gave. Right? So, John seems to, you know, at the end of the chapter 15, I think, of the gospel, Jesus says, well, arise, let us go hence. Chapter 16. Well, actually, let's sit down. I'm going to talk some more. I've been only talking for 3 chapters. I want to talk for 2 more chapters. Well, what's going on, right? What's going on? John is taking different memories that he's got and that other people have, and he's He's molding them into a beautiful narrative, but it's all guided by God because Revelation ended when the apostles died. But people always said that's John's gospel. They never said it was Peter's. It's interesting. It's very interesting. Last question. Complaints, objections, worries, anxieties. Let me see if somebody else got. You get the last dibs if nobody else does. Okay, anyone? Are you sure? I can take two more. Yes, okay.
So is there a way to apply this methodology to people who, to arguments made against the Catholic faith by people who of faith, I'm thinking like evangelicals or something.
Okay.
Who try to, they already possess faith, they already believe the Christian message, and yet they invalidate worship of Mary.
Okay. Yes.
All of these things that we hold pretty much sacrosanct, right? But they say, well, they're using the same, we're both on the same page as Christians, but mm-hmm. yet, you know, they're heretics in a sense, right? So,
how does this apply to evangelical Protestants who have the same gospel faith but doubt what we say about various traditions like the veneration of saints? I would say, here's your principle, okay? I've argued that relying on a community and a tradition and what it tells you happened in the past and tells you about human life is just as important as relying on your own autonomy, your memory, your perception, okay? Your own judgment. You need the two. And that this helps you to lead to see how it's very human and natural to believe something like the witness of some revelation. Here's the problem. Luther and his spiritual children, let's call them, want to apply that to the gospel. But then they don't want to apply it anymore after the first century. They want to distrust tradition. Because Catholic tradition in Luther's age, like in our age, said, it's good to venerate the saints. It's good to celebrate various sacraments like confession, which Luther did not accept. Right? It's good to rely on the community when it says, this is who Jesus is, he is consubstantial with the Father, etc. Okay? So I would say this. Luther wants to apply a systematic doubt about traditions that post-date the biblical era. But that, in fact, doesn't make sense because he has accepted the testimony of the first century community, but then all of a sudden the community became unreliable in its testimony. But the only way Luther could get a Bible is through the church. The Bible is the product of the church because it's the product of early oral traditions and preaching. Right? If you will, the saints are witnesses to what God has done in the past and is still doing today. Should you have a systematic distrust that what they're doing may not be accurate? I'll give you an example. All of the early Eucharistic prayers and liturgical texts for the Mass from all over the Mediterranean world, starting from the 3rd century forward, which is as far back as we can go for texts. Before then, we don't have the texts, okay? All the ancient texts for the Mass describe the Eucharist at some point in sacrificial terms, okay? There's sacrificial imagery and language used in every single tradition, in every corner of Christianity that we can find. Luther is saying they're wrong. So Luther is willing to reject the witness and the practice of the entire church in the 3rd and 4th and 5th and 6th centuries, but he'll accept the 1st century. It's inconsistent. It's inconsistent. It's a self-contradiction because Lutheranism is a tradition. Lutherans learn a tradition of how to read Scripture. It's Luther's tradition. The Reformed Protestants learn Calvin's way of reading Scripture. They're in a Calvinist tradition. They have tradition like we do. It just functions differently, and it's a different one. It's also modern. It's more recent, see? So here's parts of Protestantism, like evangelical Protestantism, are going through a big change right now. They are beginning to see that you cannot read the Bible without tradition. It's impossible. So Protestant scholars are churning out mountains of texts and volumes and editions of ancient Christian writers, especially gospel commentaries. They're fascinated by it. All those scholars, sooner or later, will become either Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic. And many of them already have, see? Right? So Luther gave the modern West the illusion that you can exist without tradition. It's an illusion. The modern skeptical enlightenment in the West is a tradition. You have to go to school and learn it. It doesn't come spontaneously, let me tell you, right? You have to learn it from a teacher who had a teacher who probably had a teacher. They're in a tradition. Is it a good tradition? Why or why not? See? What has it produced for culture, for humanity? See? Okay. Last one. Yeah.
With other examples, you can, you know, these things that you witness, they're in conformity with the laws of physics and that, the things that could possibly happen.
Okay.
Whereas these other crimes, like, just totally violates the laws of science. So
right. Yeah, I can reproduce the experiment
exactly.
In my lab.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the atheist or the agnostic or the skeptic says, well, this testimony is about supernatural phenomena which I cannot reproduce in my lab. And I can't see it happening today.
Right.
First response is, you can see it happening today because miracles still happen. You discount it because you discount the testimony. You discount the testimony because you say that testimony is not reliable. You say the testimony is not reliable because it's about the supernatural. You say the supernatural can't be believed because it violates laws of physics. But the whole claim of the supernatural is that it is supposed to go beyond the laws of physics. And the skeptic says you can't go beyond the laws of physics. And I say to you, but the laws of physics can't tell you that you can't go beyond the laws of physics. That's a philosophical claim. Show me the scientific experiment that says, as a result, that gives you the result, only the laws of physics, only what the things that respect the laws of physics can happen. This is a philosophical claim. Science cannot prove to you that only natural causes exist. Science cannot prove to you that there are no miracles. Science can say, we choose not to study miracles, which is fine. That doesn't mean they don't exist. So I say to the skeptic, you can repeat the experiment in a way. Talk to the witnesses of miracles. There's many other responses, right? So,
Mike Trout.
Mike Trout. All right.